You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 14th of May 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show,
the Secretary General urgently calls on all parties to exercise calm and restraint. He reminds all Burundian leaders of the need to preserve peace and stability in a country that has suffered so grievously from previous bouts of violence.
The UN urges calm after an attempted coup d'etat in Burundi, but the battle for power goes on. My guests Tim Marshall and Martin Plaut will tell us what the unrest could mean for the country's future. Also ahead, an Islamic State deputy is reported killed in Iraq, but what difference do the deaths of individuals make in a war against an ideology? Plus, after dabbling in debates on such matters as the Armenian genocide and Palestinian statehood, we'll discuss whether we're seeing the dawn of a new progressive Vatican. And after France pledges to pay its moral debt to Haiti, we wonder why now and who's to gain. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to the show. My guests today are Tim Marshall, former diplomatic editor at Sky News, now editor of thewhatandthewhy.com, and Martin Plaut, fellow at the Institute of Commonwealth Studies. Welcome both. We will start tonight with Burundi, whose president, Pierre Nkurunziza, appears to have joined the ignominious list of leaders who picked the wrong week for an overseas trip. Yesterday, as President Nkurunziza attended a summit in Tanzania, his former intelligence chief threw a coup d'etat. President Nkurunziza does, however, appear to command some loyalty. Heavy fighting has been reported between rival groups of soldiers in Bujumbura. Martin, I'll ask you first. The alleged coup leader, or at least the coup announcer, if that's a thing, Major General Godefroid Niyombare, do you get the sense he's thought this all the way through?
I think so. I mean, he certainly has popular support. You know, people have gone out on to the streets absolutely overjoyed with the idea that there wasn't going to be a third term, which is what the president was hoping for, against the constitution. The problem is that, you know, it isn't clear that he actually has the control of the city. It looks as if the airport is now under the control of the loyalists, and the loyalists also appear to have taken back control of the state radio. People are desperately, desperately worried. I mean, people are really cowering now, and there is a lot of heavy fighting. There was the information I had an hour ago.
I guess the key indicator in the coming hours, Tim, is whether President Nkurunziza can actually land his plane anywhere.
The rumours are, and that's all they are, that he has left Tanzania. So where is he? Is he en route? Or is he? I can't believe he would be driving. And so he may well be in the air trying to get back to land at the airport. The airport's right on the outskirts of town. The presidential palace is at the other side of the city. And the radio station where the fighting is going on is bang in the city centre, only about a mile in from the shore of the lake. And I would argue at the moment from this distance that the loyalists probably control all three and possibly most of the roads. So I think it is possible for him to maybe get back. But in the past examples, presidents often sort of hang around for a bit outside to make sure that they can get in, because, you know, this is life and death matter, not just tens of thousands of potential civilians dying, but the president himself knows if he gets this decision wrong,
you come home and find a firing squad in the terminal.
Yes. So so he's not gone back. But I'll see your major general from intelligence that announced the coup, and I'll raise you the army chief of staff. And the army chief of staff has come out and said he supports the president. So that is why the fighting's going on, and we don't know which way it's going to go. And the only glimmer of good news, as Martin will know better than I, is that at the moment it's not ethnic. It is not Hutu versus Tutsi. If it comes into that, then the place is going to fall apart. If they can hold it just at a political level, then there'll be a solution one way or the other for either the president or overthrowing the president. It's only if it goes into an ethnic strife, that's when we are looking at a smaller version of Rwanda, but involving a huge amount of death.
Martin, that is, of course, I think that is the outcome that the entire watching world is desperately hoping does not come about. And as Tim was saying, so far there are no reports of any sectarian splits amid the police and the military. Is it possible I guess, to discuss what might lead to such a thing. Is it the kind of thing that would happen of its own accord? I mean, I guess what I'm asking is, what is the default position? Is the default position that the institutions will cohere over and above ethnic division, or is the default position that the ethnic divisions will make themselves noticeable again?
Well, in a way, the default position would be that things might fall apart on one condition, which is that the Rwandans intervene.
Yeah.
Now, the Rwandans have already made noises about what is going on and are suggesting that the FDLR, the Rwandan rebel Hutu militia, who are operating from Congo, are perhaps involved in what's going on in Burundi. And this might be a way of suggesting to the Burundian military that if they don't pull their finger out, that the Rwandans will intervene. Now, of course, the situation in Rwanda and Burundi are exactly the reverse of each other. In Rwanda, the Tutsi minority are in absolute control. So 10-15% of the population run the country. In Burundi, it's the other way around. The 10-15%, whatever it is, of the population that is Tutsi are not in control, and it is the Hutu who are in control. So you can see why the Rwandans, looking at the Burundi situation, might be very nervous, because they may feel that, you know, if we let things get out of control in Burundi, then perhaps the FDLR will indeed have a base from which to operate. Now, that hasn't happened in the past, but it could open it up to that. And that's why the Rwandans might intervene.
Martin's brought in all that context, and I think it's crucial to do so, because you can't get a handle on it. And a very quick history tells us there was a civil war, 300,000 people died. It was partially, mostly ethnic. The way to solve it was to have a new constitution. The new constitution said 2 terms as a president. The president's now going to stand for a third. He says, yeah, but it was the parliament that elected me for the first term. Therefore, I've only had 1 term elected by the people. And that's what sparked the whole argument. But that's only a symbol of the tensions underneath. And so that's where we are now. And absolutely, the president of Rwanda will not stand idly by if it turns into an ethnic war. And they will probably enter. And then you're talking about the DRC, Tanzania, and the other neighbours, all of which have extremely fragile societies at the moment. But as I said, at the moment, it is not ethnic. It is, I mean, the fighting is fierce and it looks awful, but it's not huge army brigades up against each other. It is small units that have taken sides.
President Paul Kagame of Rwanda, on past form, is not one of life's stand-by-ers, and it would be entirely easy to imagine him intervening for all the reasons that you mentioned in the circumstances you describe. But Martin, is there a useful role to be played here by any outside powers, or even any non-African powers? Is there a case yet for some sort of peacekeeping force or intervention, or is, for the moment at least, possibly cold and cynical though it sounds, is it something that the Burundians need to be left to sort out for themselves?
Well, I don't think there's any chance, because, I mean, you know, quite frankly, who has an operational force capable of really intervening? I mean, there's one rumour that the Nkurunziza has gone to Uganda. Now, the Ugandans have troops that might have been able to intervene, but I mean, they're heavily bogged down in South Sudan and in Somalia. Do they really want to get into another war? And I think this is something they're going to let the Burundians get on with. I mean, the East African community have made lots of noises saying, oh, it's terrible that we're having a coup. The African Union's default position is, of course, that they are against coups. I mean, it's not for nothing that they were known as a club of dictators. You know, they frankly back each other to the hilt and always will do. I mean, I suppose France might have done something, but I don't know that they have. I mean, do you think they have anyone in the area?
I don't think so, but if it began to be a Rwanda, I think there would be, because there has been a Rwanda, relatively fresh in the memory, I think there would be global outrage and there would be a push. What can we do? That's different to actually doing something. I was at an open forum speaking on Monday at the Global Diplomatic Forum, and the deputy head of mission of the American embassy was there, and we talked about Burundi. And I reminded her that President Clinton had said never again after Rwanda, that the American promise. And she said, yeah, you know, we would hold by that promise. Now, we didn't go into details, but, you know, it is something that I think the leaders of the world are aware of. And I do think that if it slid very quickly, there would be a flurry of meetings to try and do something, but actually doing something. I mean, you know where it is, Martin. It's in the middle of Africa. It's not, you don't just sort of suddenly pony up about 10,000 troops and move in.
Okay, well, let's look now at Iraq, another possible partial success as a case study and intervention. Iraq's military are claiming that a small but significant blow has been struck against Islamic State, specifically that a coalition airstrike near Tal Afar in the north has accounted for Islamic State's alleged number two, Abu Ala al-Afri, and a senior security official named Akram Kirbash. Now, if this is true, and the Pentagon has not confirmed the reports, it's difficult to argue that either man is a great loss to the furtherance of human enlightenment. But are they a great loss to the Islamic State? So I guess the question, and I'll put it to you first, Tim, is Islamic State as an idea strong enough to survive its initial leadership?
The idea of it, yes, but the actual movement itself, as a grouping and as an organization, no. It will splinter. I mean, it would splinter with or without these guys, because it is in the nature of that type of revolutionary that you'll find they will, you know, if there was three of them, they'd split into five factions.
This is the Judean People's Front and the People's Front of Judea.
Which is one of the great satires of truth. This is partially an intellectual argument about the great theories of history about whether leaders forge history or people or ideas. And I think all of those do. The Islamic State will splinter with or without these two guys dying. If the two guys have died, there'll be a small power struggle. And these things do matter. And let me come to something that isn't perhaps a revolutionary, a news organization. A new man or woman takes charge at the top and has a direction and a vision and hires some people and they have ideas and the news organization goes down that road. Well, if they make the wrong decisions and if they don't bring people with them, that news organization fails. And it's the same in any other organization, and that includes a revolutionary murderous organization like ISIS. So I think it does matter very much who leaders are. But I just don't think it's the deciding factor of history. I mean, if Hitler had been killed in 43, would the war have gone on for two more years? Maybe not.
Martin, is there genuine strategic value as well as obvious, psychological propaganda value in whacking the leaders of a movement like IS?
I'm sure there is. I was just wondering which news organization Tim was thinking of.
Any news organization. That was not...
I was rising manfully above the temptation if he was speaking from particular experience.
But... And my recent experience is extremely good and extremely successful.
Let's leave that aside then. Look, I think it certainly does matter. Every movement that I've ever known always says, it's not about personalities, it's about the policy. It's about the integrity of the movement, and it's never true. Mm. I mean, personalities are extremely important and can hold things together. I mean, can you imagine the independence of India, for example, without somebody like Gandhi or Nehru? I mean, it would have been completely and utterly different. If one of those had died, it would have been...
You need a uniting factor.
Exactly.
And people can unite. They can also divide, of course.
And the other thing is that, I think one shouldn't underestimate the gradual degradation of the ISIS machine, which is happening from the air. I mean, they are under constant and never-ending attack from the drones, from the air, from airstrikes, and from, of course, special forces on the ground, which nobody's talking about, but I'm quite sure are there and are directing what's going on. So they are gradually being downgraded. Now, at what point will they genuinely be pushed back? At what point will the state be able to genuinely muster enough support from the Sunni groups? That I don't know. And really be able to push back against them and really begin to shrink them as an organization. I don't know the situation well enough, but I mean, one day, it is a long, slow process, but I think it is inexorable.
Tim, on the subject of the influence and importance of leaders, especially with a revolutionary movement, by targeting them, though, is there not a risk of legitimizing the movement or even making it more appealing by creating martyrs? I mean, the one example that leaps to mind, if you think going back nearly 100 years to the Easter Rising in Dublin, the ringleaders were monumentally unpopular when they were detained after throwing this somewhat chaotic revolt, which, left the city
in ruins.
And
they were then killed by the British.
And they were then executed by the British and made international heroes.
Yes, I think that's absolutely right. But you're comparing like with like in the sense that there's a revolutionary movement and there's a revolutionary movement.
Indeed so.
But of course, the difference between ISIS in the desert and the chaos and the ability of a small island nation like the Irish to organize and to survive taking out the leadership. It's very, very different. Your point is absolutely correct. You can create martyrs and you can create such anger that people actually support it more. And I think in the Irish case, you're right. I think in ISIS, that's not going to happen.
I mean, one other point is that the Irish did have W.B. Yeats behind them and, you know, a terrible beauty is born. I mean, what a phrase. I mean, that absolutely, you know, it just encapsulated what was going on and, you know, it was the basis of what, you know, went forward.
I mean, in other campaigns or other theatres, with all due acknowledgement of the difficulty of comparing one struggle with another, in recent years, have targeted assassinations, and I'll put this to you first, Martin, do they seem to have a track record of success? Because Israel, at various points, has been very keen on it, certainly against leaders of the PLO, Hamas, Hezbollah, and if rumours are to be believed, various Iranian physicists. The drone campaign by the United States in Yemen, Afghanistan, Pakistan. All things considered, do they look like success stories?
Well, let me give you one that was an absolute stonking success. The blowing of Admiral Carrero Blanco over a church in Spain after Franco's death. Do you remember that happening?
No.
The Basques did it. Carrero Blanco was the man who was supposed to prevent Spain from returning to democracy. He was the man in charge. They blew him over a church, and the death of one man freed the king. The king then came out and said, look, we're going to go back to democracy. This fascism is a bad idea. And it was a total transformation. I'm not saying there are many examples like that, but that is one worth bearing in mind.
Tim, and a final thought on this. Those recent campaigns, as one we were mentioning, especially, you know, the Israeli one and the United States, do they look, given that, you know, Israel's struggle with Palestine goes on, or struggle against, or there's almost no way you can phrase that now that I think of it, isn't going to upset somebody, but I'm sure people know what I mean. That goes on, it remains unresolved, ditto what remains of the war on terror. Have those campaigns been successful?
Again, I'm afraid it's back to the different examples. Sometimes yes, sometimes no. And it is war by another means as well, taking out leaders. People do need organizational ability. And if you take them out, and if you take out the ideologues as well, you are striking a blow often. It's just down to individual examples. And I think on the whole, I think they are probably more successful than unsuccessful. And I'm not saying either way, whether it's a good thing or a bad thing.
Well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller, along with Tim Marshall and Martin Plout. Coming up next, are we seeing a new side to the Vatican?
From her perch in Wan Chai, Aisha Spears is Monocle's Hong Kong bureau chief. Covering topics ranging from territorial disputes to urban upsets, the luxury goods sector to organic farming, Aisha Spears boasts one of the best beats at Monocle.
From the expanding political influence of Beijing to the growing economic power of Southeast Asia's middle class, we look at the people, businesses and nations that are shaping the exciting Asia-Pacific region.
From Sukhumvit to Orchard Road, Aisha Spears is Monocle's woman in Hong Kong and beyond. Catch her reports and check-ins around the clock right here on Monocle 24.
And welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me are Tim Marshall, editor of the What and the Why.com, late of Sky News, and Martin Plout from the Institute of Commonwealth Studies. Now, it does seem at some levels idle to even think about the Vatican as a beacon of progressive thought. The Catholic Church remains an organisation which believes women incapable of holding senior managerial rank is institutionally beholden to some incredibly weird ideas about gay people and only got around to admitting that Galileo was onto something in 1992. But everything is relative, and Pope Francis has recently taken some notably leftward positions on the 1915 genocide of the Armenians, and more recently on Palestinian statehood, of which the Vatican is now in favour. Tim, does it matter what the Pope thinks and what the Vatican thinks?
Absolutely it matters, for various reasons, not least of there being a billion Catholics in the world, of which a percentage listen to what he has to say, not so much on birth control and things like that, but or sex before marriage, but there are things that the Vatican does lead on, and he does lead. And Trying to think of some examples. Yeah, this matters. It was this particular pope that, when he went to Cuba, had some very quiet conversations. Then he had some quiet conversations with the Americans. And he is one of the people that has put together Castro and Obama. And he is one of the people that looks like he's going to lead to diplomatic negotiations and then relations between those two countries. So he has a real role in that. He has his own Secretary of State, his own Foreign Secretary, if you like, Monsignor Powellin, I think it is. And they do a lot of work. And yes, it does matter. I mean, you know, if you're dogmatic and if you are left of center and don't like organized religion, which may or may not be true from your introduction, you might take a dim view that they shouldn't be interfering themselves in the affairs of man. But the fact is that they are a player. They're not a massive player, but they're a player.
I wasn't trying to get to, you know, how many divisions has the Pope over here, but it is intriguing the influence he still and the institution has even in non-Catholic countries. Turkey were terribly upset about his remarks on the Armenian genocide. They recalled their ambassador. Israel has been predictably unpleased that the Vatican wants to recognize Palestine. But on that specific example, and I'll put this to you, Martin, apart from annoying Israel, does the Vatican recognizing Palestine actually do the Palestinian people any good?
Well, it certainly cheers them up, and they haven't had much to be cheerful about for a long, long time. I mean, of course, it's not going to change facts on the ground. But, you know, he is a man of great influence. And, you know, as you say, Tim, a billion people can't be ignored, and they take him terribly seriously. Therefore, so should we. I mean, the fact that he has now rejected the French ambassador because he was overtly gay. I mean, frankly, I think it was the French just trying to make a point out of it. And, you know, why make a point with the Vatican? You know where the Vatican comes from. There's no point in trying to rub their nose in what you're doing. It was just a bit of a silly move, I think, by the French. What were they going to gain out of it? They knew what the response would be.
Well, the Vatican did have the option of rising above that response, of course.
But, you know, why should they? I mean, we don't, for example, you wouldn't have somebody who was overtly opposed to Islam being appointed to an Islamic state. You know,
the man who was going to be French ambassador to the Vatican is a practicing Catholic. He is a practicing gay Catholic, but he is a practicing Catholic, so he's not opposed to Catholicism.
But he clearly does not accept one of the tenets of the Catholic faith. Therefore, you know, why would you don't go around egregiously insulting people? It's pointless.
I'm sure plenty of ambassadors have been sent to the Holy See who are practicing Catholics and yet take a slightly more liberal view on things like, as Tim said, birth control.
Yes, but there's a difference between being slightly more liberal and being openly gay.
Well, I for one would beg to differ.
You beg to differ, but you're looking at it from your perspective and not the Vatican's perspective.
Yes.
Well, indeed so. But, you know,
then come on, you defend your position.
My position is that...
Is this our program now?
Yeah, exactly.
Is this a coup?
Yes, yeah, I think so.
My position is that were I in charge of, you know, some quaint little European state, and it is
like France?
Like France or indeed the Vatican, but... I would take no particular view on the sexual orientation of ambassadors dispatched by foreign-friendly powers.
Despite the fact that it was absolutely integral to your system of beliefs.
Yeah, but it's not integral to my system of beliefs.
But that's the weakness of your position.
Yeah, but I'm right.
But and modest, too.
on this particular subject. Tim, though, there is a point there. Does those occasional outbursts of illiberalism by the Vatican, and there is obviously because the Vatican is what it is, there will also always be an illiberal core at the heart of it. Does it undermine any positions it may want to take on more progressive things, including the encyclical on things like climate change, which he's believed to be preparing?
They are. They're going to come out big time on climate change and tell big business in the international system, you're doing it wrong, you're killing the world. You know, which is going to be quite a statement for a billion people to be influenced, how they think about climate change and big business. So, as we agree again, matters hugely. And if you're talking about the fundamental tenets of doctrine, no, I don't think it does them any harm at all. You're talking about the head of the Catholic Church talking about what are considered Catholic issues to the Catholic faithful. I don't think it it undermines them at all. This is a separate issue about whether I believe that or whether I think that's a good thing. I mean, that's irrelevant if I think it's a good thing or not, because I don't have a dog in the fight. I mean, I might as well declare. I personally think that they should have seen themselves to be progressive and say, okay, if you want to have a practicing gay Catholic ambassador, we will have it. We still reserve the right not to like it, but we're not going to stand in your way. And that would, to me, show a Christian attitude of openness, tolerance, and forgiveness. They chose not to because, as we've pointed out, the French were actually sort of deliberately trying to make a little bit of trouble. But in what does the Vatican lose? But, you know, is the Pope a Catholic? I believe he is.
On the subject of France, and finally tonight, President Francois Hollande did attract considerable notice earlier this week when he became the first major Western leader since the 80s to visit Havana. His subsequent Haiti has attracted less noticed, but maybe at least as significant. He spoke of a moral debt that France owes to its perennially luckless former colony. Martin, what does he mean by that, and is he right?
Well, when one shouldn't forget that when Haiti finally was given independence, the French demanded a repayment for their independence debt of 150 million gold francs. And the poor Haitians only got round to finally paying this the last drop in 1947.
So not it France's is finest much, hour.
Not their finest hour. And, you know, this was for things like the land that had been taken from the Haitians in the first place and the slaves that the Haitians had freed. I mean, it was an appalling thing to do. Now, there is another issue, which is that a few years ago, a group of Caribbean states have now asked that not just France repay some of the debts of slavery, but that also, for example, Britain should repay.
Which is why it's not going to happen.
Exactly. And that is a much more difficult issue.
Because there is a wider question here, and I'll put this to you, Tim. It's the one about at what point does a former colony cease to have any draw on the moral or monetary conscience of its former colonizer? At what point is the colonizer allowed to say it was a long time ago?
Well, there is no book I can take down from the shelf and dust off. Oh yes, well actually it's 50 years or whatever. The Germans are still paying reparations to Israel. Greece is now wanting more reparations from Germany because of World War II. I don't know. At what point do you? The French position, and they're doing a very good job, actually. They're out there much more than the British in the Middle East and now in the Caribbean. They're saying, okay, Sarkozy wrote off the debt when he was president of
just shortly after the earthquake in 2010.
Right. And then secondly, the French president's position, and I'll come to exactly why, but is we will help to fund and invest because we recognize our moral historic debt to you, but we're not going to get into paying you reparations. And it's precisely because if France has to pay reparations to Haiti for something from 200 years ago, then it's got to pay reparations to here, there, everywhere, all over Africa, then the British have to, and the Spanish, and the Portuguese, and the Dutch, and so they're all going to keep quiet about this, and so I don't think it's going to happen, but there absolutely is a moral imperative that France has to have a relationship with Haiti to make up for not only what it did during slavery, but then it pretty much nailed them to the economic floor and kept them down until the debt was repaid, I think, 1949. Hmm. And, like year zero, you start with nothing in 1949.
Time for a very final and unfortunately brief thought on this, Martin, along similar lines. At what point does the former colony cease being the former colonizer's problem?
Well, I think it's an impossible question to answer, but let me just put this thought in your mind. At what point should Morocco pay Britain for the 400 attacks by the Barbary pirates on Cornwall and Devon?
And the Polisario Front, but let's not go there.
And I'm still wondering who I invoice for the unpaid labour done by my convict ancestors in building a British Empire outpost.
Quite
in
right.
The Thanks States. For that. The pleasure was all theirs. That is all we have time for on today's edition of Midori House. Tim Marshall and Martin Plout, thank you very much for joining us. The show was produced by Alice Block, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Caroline Hamagrin. Our studio manager was Toby Hammond. Josh Fennett is up next with Monocle's international playlist. The Urbanist follows that at 1900 hours. And at 2200, Emma Nelson and Nancy Durham are here with the Monocle Daily. Midori House returns tomorrow at 1800 London time. But for this edition, it's goodbye. Thanks very much for listening.